welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between personal and individual well-being and the well-being of our communities, the well-being of our food, water, earth, and air, the well-being of our society, not doing too well nowadays, the role of the media, the role of policy, the role of science, all of the above, and of course, the ecological stability and generosity of our planet Earth are all huge factors in our health, our well-being, our survival, our very lives. Each week on the show, we cover different facets of how the many different things going on in different sectors of the environment impact us and impact our collective health. On today's show, I am thrilled to have joining us Jordan Chariton of the Young Turks Network. We've had previous guests from Young Turks, and I've actually been a guest on their network as well. And it's just a thrill to have Jordan with us today. He is a political reporter for the Young Turks, and he began with reporting on the presidential campaign trail, went on and did fantastic coverage of the entire Standing Rock uprising, which we covered extensively on the show. In his role, he interviews candidates, advisors, and the actual everyday people pundits on TV love bloviating about. Before he was at coming to TYT, Jordan was a reporter for the Rap and TV Newser and has also freelanced for Salon and Media. Mediaite. I don't know how to pronounce that. And he actually also served, because he's a New York East Coast guy, as digital producer, New York City's famous 92nd Street Y, where he was nominated for a Webby Award in the politics category. And I have to say, when TYT, the Young Turks Network, hired Jordan Chariton to cover the presidential campaign of 2016, it was a perfect match of an astute, dedicated, investigative, tireless, and insightful reporter with the, you know, the kind of turning point moment for our lives, which was last year's campaign and the aftermath of it and what we do coming forward. So there couldn't have been a better match. On this show, we'll also be discussing his book, Corporate Con Job, about the role of the media. And, you know, there's a lot to say about that as well. So happy to have you here. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Jordan Chariton.
Wow, you're a lot nicer to me than even my mother.
I'm sure she's, if I knew you better, I'd probably, you know, kind of be at, you know, a few points below, let's be real. But, you know, but whatever she did, she must have been doing right, because you are so well equipped for your moment and place and time to be telling, you know, to be bearing witness and reporting on what you are, and to be telling the stories that you are and reflecting back, the, you know, the real truth of what is going on in our world, which really is the role of people in the media, although some have become hypnotized, deluded, or, you know, brainwashed and have kind of really forgotten what the role of media in a democracy, and especially in a declining democracy, which is what we have, must be. So, you know, tell us, you know, what drove you, what inspired you to begin writing the book, and we'll talk more about the book and how people can access it as well.
Yeah, sure, and thanks for having me. I wouldn't say regrets, but one thing I wish I could have done during the campaign and Standing Rock and Flint and everything else I've been covering is write in real time. Writing has really been a passion of mine for a long time, but, you know, 20-hour days on the campaign trail or Standing Rock, you don't have a lot of time to capture it in real time for a book. So I, you know, was continuing to report, and I was seeing the corporate media, particularly the cable news outlets, kind of do this, I think, like con job / jujitsu, where, you know, after elevating Trump and basically giving him a never-ending 24/7 pedestal for the last 2 years, all of a sudden, you know, they were the, you know, watchers on the wall and fighting for truth and trying to save the democracy against Trump. And the hypocrisy rubbed me the wrong way. And I said, you know what? I'm never going to have enough time to write. There's never going to be a good time. TYT keeps me busy. So, you know, I'm just going to find a way to do it. And I came up with the idea to, instead of trying to put together a finished product and sell it in bookstores, why don't I just write and release it in real time while I'm going? Hopefully that builds up some excitement. You know, I've released the introduction, chapter one. I just finished chapter two, and we'll be putting that up soon. And, you know, I really want my account of what happened because I really think, frankly, there was very, you know, we have a lot of great independent media out there, but when I was on the trail, it was really me, particularly covering Bernie, Standing Rock. There wasn't a lot of well-known independent media out there. So if my account of what actually happened doesn't get out there, we might forget what actually happened in 2016, which was frankly the, you know, cabal between the banks, the lobbyists, the corporations, the media, and the politicians, stopping a very historic and threatening to them campaign dead in their tracks. So I wanted to make sure the truth and what actually happened got out there. So that was the inspiration.
Yeah. And, you know, that brings up a really, really interesting and important point because, you know, a lot of people, as you say, there are a lot of, you know, independent journalistic outlets and everything. But, you know, we have a completely changed media landscape. You know, there's a legacy media where reporters are paid to, you know, kind of do their job and also within certain very, you know, narrowly hewed lines, which is the subject of, you know, your book portrays that better than anything I've ever seen, what actually goes on there. And then there are hosts of, you know, independent and progressive and other outlets, but, you know, they may not have the funding or the budget. They very likely, most of them don't, to be sending people out on the campaign trail. And so, you know, in state by state or location by location, reporters may show up, you know, for example, along the trail and cover locally. But, you know, a lot of people won't see that coverage, and the reporters, you know, are very poorly compensated. Their travel isn't, you know, made possible, and so there's very little actually available on a national level, you know, for an independent view like yours to be sustained, to be out there, and to be available to the public, and that's why it's so important that what you saw be something that people know about and connect with, because if people are just tuning in to the corporate media, they're going to see something else. And in fact, this creates two different realities, you know, where people are believing, you know, some people are seeing one reality because they're open to it or they show up or they're participating. And, you know, other people are really being spoon-fed another reality. And then they're shocked and stunned when, you know, we find ourselves where we now are. Can you, you know, share some stories of, you know, how you saw the contrast between the reality before your eyes that you were, you know, documenting and what the corporate media was covering?
Yeah, portraying. I mean, I think you put it really well. I think that for me, I was very, very lucky. You know, I had experience and I had a pretty decent resume, but it's one of those things. I met Cenk at the right time, and I must have said something right and got this opportunity. And I had always felt that not only is it the right thing to do to actually tell the stories of real people and not just have pundits on air just blowing smoke up each other's behinds, I actually thought it could actually do well, like as a business model. I think people would want to watch actual, authentic interviews with everyday Americans. So when I was on the road, you know, obviously I'd go covering the primaries and the debates and, you know, whatever it was, conventions, but I'd also, thanks to the Young Turks, I would get to these primaries, you know, 5-6 days earlier, a week earlier, and I would cover stories happening in the local community. One thing that comes to mind before the Indiana primary, a TYT viewer had emailed me, and, you know, I get like a gazillion emails. but I just happened to look at this one. And she had sent me an article from the New York Times saying Elkhart, Indiana is roaring back. Elkhart, Indiana is a, they call it the RV capital of the country. And in the 2008 election, it was hit very hard because of the crash. It had like 20% unemployment, which was the highest of any city in the country. So the New York Times had done a piece basically citing some businesses that were doing better to say Elkhart is coming back. And a resident, an actual person, emailed me saying this is complete nonsense. If it's coming back, yeah, maybe for half the homes left because half the homes have been foreclosed. So I, you know, left covering the primary and I went for 2 days to interview this formerly middle-class woman, now a single mother living in a trailer park with her two kids. And I sat there for 2 days. We spoke in her home. She took me for a driving tour around the city, showing me closed down youth centers, closed down factories, closed down buildings. And that was like my first up close taste at the disconnect between like what the lazy, in many cases, corrupt corporate media tells their audiences versus like if you actually go out and get the story from real people. That was a really jarring thing because it's like, how does the New York Times, which I mean, if I have to admit it, I used to love. I mean, I used to be naive, just like a lot of consumers. How does the New York Times write a story like this? With they probably didn't even go there, you know, to speak with people when all you got to do is be there for 20 minutes, half hour to see this is not a town that is coming roaring back. There's a lot of other examples. I was in Portland for the Oregon primary, and I went to a outdoor tent city. Basically a houseless village. Before that, I used to call it like a homeless village, but they explained we call it houseless because home is where the heart is. So just because you don't have a home doesn't mean you don't have a heart. And I was shocked because like it was completely empty. There was no one to interview because like everybody was at work. So this is like the working poor who can't afford to get an apartment or a house at a houseless tent city. And then I go back to the hotel later and like I put on MSNBC and they're talking about how home equity is up and the economy is doing better. So these disconnects happened all over the country. And as I say in the book, I mean, really the corporate media, it's in their best interest to push the narrative that things are getting better. And in reality, how would they know? Most of these journalists, aside from occasionally interviewing voters during the campaign, they don't get out to Rust Belt states in off election years and actually do stories on, you know, the housing crisis or healthcare or, you know, income inequality or drug issues or none of those things. So there is a large scale disconnect going on. And I think, you know, fortunately with the Young Turks, and I owe them a lot of credit, they are investing in me doing this kind of reporting. Our viewers have invested so we could do more of it. I've been allowed to do that kind of stuff rather than follow, you know, the nonsense horse race all day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I just interject. It's really apparent if you, during the election year or at any time, turn on MSNBC, you know, a supposedly liberal outlet, for example. You know, it's all, so much of it is about the whole horse race and the us versus them. And it's not like there isn't them to be extremely concerned about. But the whole us versus them narrative, and all we have to do is cheer for the right side, and that's the way we engage. And the fact that these outlets don't even do what you're doing is actually journalism. That's what journalism traditionally did. That's why journalism is needed, to give a true portrayal of what's going on in the society, so that, you know, one doesn't have to merely be in one's own individual silo to understand what's going on. And one of the things that happened with the Clinton campaign is that, you know, retrospectively, although they have never acknowledged it, you know, a lot of people have pointed out that the campaign was out of touch. What you're pointing out is it's not just the campaign that was out of touch. If the media is out of touch, if the media isn't, you know, is putting forth a scenario for some reason or other, rather than reporting on what's actually happening, then all the people are out of touch. You know, everybody that's following that news media is out of touch, and therefore, instead of addressing problems, they keep getting worse and worse. And if, you know, the current presidential situation isn't, you know, the clearest evidence of that, I kind of don't know what is. But they're not actually doing their job. Why did they stop doing their job? What do they have to gain from putting forth this kind of concocted scenario? Because what you're describing is, here's what's happening in one town, and they're telling us something else is happening, completely opposite of what is actually happening. Why would they be doing that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm currently working, I just finished chapter two, actually, and a lot of it, it's on covering Trump, which was a challenge, because how do you make Trump interesting to progressives? We're all just sick of hearing about the man. But I go into detail about the history of, you know, these media outlets used to be known that you're going to lose money out of your news division. You know, if you were a corporation that owned a news department, and that was just, it was called, these were loss leaders. You would lose money, but it was part of your brand. It was part of, you know, public service. So maybe you made the money in your entertainment shows or sports, but news was to inform. News was not for profit. Kind of like healthcare way back in the day. And then, you know, starting with Reagan and then under Bill Clinton, they basically took away any regulation. There was little regulation as it is. And essentially what you got was huge multi-billion dollar conglomerates taking over our public airwave industries, seizing control. So, you know, one corporation could basically assume control of 200 little stations or things like that. And basically, at the same time, most of these corporations are lobbying, hiring lobbyists to lobby on their behalf for everything that the progressive movement is fighting against, you know, tax subsidies, deregulation for them, basic conservative goodies. So you have makeup-laced anchors or journalists, if you want to call them that, working for these big corporate conglomerates who basically are crapping on the viewers. They are doing things. So like General Electric, for example, owned NBC for a while. General Electric was one of the biggest nuclear manufacturers in the country. And they don't exactly care about, you know, healthcare for all or free public tuition or any of those things. So when you give control over to, in my view, social Darwinists who don't care about, you know, who don't buy into this prospect of we're all in this together, even though data shows when you have income equality, wealthy people do even better. Well, what do you expect to be on the airwaves? And I worked at Fox, I worked at MSNBC. It's a wink and a nod culture. Everybody knows, you know, you can only go so far towards the line, but there's certain things you cannot cover. You know, do you see MSNBC covering net neutrality? Of course not, because they're owned by Comcast, who does not want net neutrality. Do you see CNN covering, you know, single payer or even giving Bernie, which I talk a lot about in chapter one, equal airtime to Trump, even though they had the same amount of people at their rallies? I mean, I was at both of these rallies, probably 20 to 30 each between Bernie and Trump. Bernie had more people at his rallies. It was a lie when Trump was saying, I have the biggest rallies, yet he got like one-tenth of the coverage because Time Warner, which owns CNN, which is trying to sell to AT&T, they don't want to be pushing single-payer health care or tax hikes on the wealthy and corporations. So it's a distorted thing. It would be like allowing Goldman Sachs to take control of, like, you know, mom and pop lemonade stands, you know. And unfortunately, most people don't know the history. They don't know. It's not a sexy topic like media ownership. But honestly, it's just as dangerous what's happened with this seizing of the media as as many other things like the deregulation of financial industries and this and that, because Amy Goodman says it best, if you don't have an informed public, you can't have a democracy.
That's the truth. You know, since we're drilling into this particular thing, I want to ask you something, because what you've just explained, I don't believe is really widely understood. And during the course, you know, I mean, actually, because I've been in the media for, you know, a couple of decades, the minute it all started in with Trump, I was like, I don't want to be, you know, I wasn't watching it. I turned it off. I'm like, I'm not watching this. It's not going to... it's just giving him more viewership. It's twisting the conversation. It's all becoming Trump and anti-Trump. This isn't the way this, you know, what's going on here should be reported. And I just kind of shifted away from it. And yet, what actually happened, I saw, was that a lot of people became addicted to it. You know, they were like, you know, they were opposed to him, but they became obsessed with him. They forgot the issues. They forgot what was at stake. It was just this kind of addictive fascination and hating him. So he became, you know, like the buffoon clown that, you know, everybody wanted to beat up on. But meanwhile, they're tuning in and they're not talking policy. They're not looking at the impact of on the environment or on climate or on any or healthcare or any of this. They're just like looking, you know, they're just participating in the clown show. And at the time when I would tell people that, they would agree with me while still being addicted to watching him. And they would say things like, well, did you hear the head of CBS say he's terrible for democracy but great for ratings? And that became like this little tisk tisk, I shake my head and, you know, ain't the networks awful? But there, you know, but that's kind of like, well, I get it. We all want ratings. You know, that must be what's going on. What you've just said is that that's not what's going on. I've often thought, I said, look, you know, the president of CBS doesn't say things by accident. You know, it's scripted for PR. He's not telling you it's ratings because it is ratings. That's the cover. It's actually that these are corporations, you know, when you say multinational corporation, they're not invested in one sole business. They have investments across the board that they're trying to protect through the media coverage done by their outlets. And yet, you know, that somehow is like walking and chewing gum at the same time for people to understand that it's not just about ratings. It was the good old days when it was just about ratings. I'd love to hear your comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is, just to boil it down if people don't understand, what is the difference between Alex Jones, who corporate media and journalists have been screaming about that Megyn Kelly gave him a platform, which I agree, I don't think she should have, but what is the difference between and Megyn Kelly doing that and all of these outlets that gave up the birther-in-chief unending coverage? There is no difference. Birtherism is born on racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and they gave Donald Trump never-ending coverage. I write in Chapter 2, which I just finished, about Jake Tapper. Jake Tapper, for example, with CNN, of all the, you know, kind of fake journalists there, I actually like him the best. I think he's somewhat decent. But he interviewed Donald Trump during the campaign. Donald Trump plays dumb about David Duke and not knowing the KKK. Either Donald Trump was lying or Donald Trump is a moron, because you should know the KKK or David Duke, but an actual journalistic enterprise, frankly, would have ended the interview. You don't give somebody dog whistling about the KKK or David Duke a platform. Also, they didn't do their research, because in the year 2000, Donald Trump had said, I won't join the Reform Party, when he was trying to stoke up interest in a possible presidential run then, because of people like David Duke. My point is, if somebody could make them money, which Donald Trump can, he's not a step too far. You know, even though he pushed birtherism, even though he has pushed very vile things like saying the Central Park Five in the 90s should go to jail, even though he never retracted it when it came out that they did not assault that woman. But the point is, the corporate media and executives like Les Moonves, they're not particularly interested. Their top priority is not informing the public, activating the public, or dare I say, in some cases, advocating for the public. The top priority is profit. Profit for themselves, profit for the shareholders. And until that changes, which I think independent media like the Young Turks, Democracy Now!, Secular Talk, Jimmy Dore, you know, Lee Camp, the list goes on and on, until you take the profit motive outside of media, you're going to have a lot of uninformed people, misinformed people, and in a lot of cases, unfortunately, these misinformed or uninformed people take actions, take violent actions. I'm not one who blames the media if somebody does something violent, but let me tell you, at these Trump rallies, I met and interviewed probably hundreds of people. Most of these people were not bad people, and most of them were actually not racist, but all of them were misinformed or uninformed, and that's coming directly from whether it be Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or even the New York Times. I mean, the Washington Post, for example, reported a story a few weeks ago that Russia had hacked into Vermont's electric grid and shut it down. Zero truth to that. They didn't retract it. They just put an editor's note up. And this is the Washington Post. You know, of course, we all make mistakes sometimes, but these mistakes or these reporting without context or reporting with a bias and narrative goes on every day. So my point is, I think the time for talking about media fairness is over. Like, action needs to be taken. And that's why I'm happy to be at the Young Turks, because I believe in, you know, doing rather than talking. And we're doing what should be done. I don't have a problem if Fox News is conservative or if CNN is establishment. Just put it out there. There you are, so people know, and they can make a decision whether they want to consume it. But when CNN is pretending to be neutral and the, you know, what, the most trusted name in news, they don't even report news anymore. If you watch CNN all throughout the day, you might find a sliver, maybe 5% of their day is on anything unrelated to Trump, Russia, or politics. And that's not news. That is a business model. It's infotainment. And it's not just CNN. Unfortunately, it's all of them now. It's even gone to what used to be formerly progressive outlets like the Huffington Post, who have now changed their model to like Trump derangement syndrome. And it's unfortunate. It really is. And, you know, it's not going to change overnight. But the more independent, fearless people we have out there, the more informed the public will be.
Can you define for our listeners infotainment? You know, when you say this is a business model, you know, I'd love to hear you kind of unpack that a little bit more. So, you know, you're saying that, you know, how does that come about? Is that that's a conscious choice? It's a business plan. They know this is what they're doing. But, you know, the public is still thinking, oh, I've listened to this for, you know, the last 10 years and this is actually, this is journalism. I mean, how does that come about? What is that model?
I mean, CNN's a great example. During the campaign, if you watch their advertisements for debates that were coming up on their network, I mean, if you looked away, you could have been listening to a promo for like a boxing match. They had a bell and like this dramatic music, and it was almost promoting like a sporting event. You see every day on cable news, you know, put Democratic strategists in the left side of the screen, Republican strategist on the right side of the screen, an attractive person in the middle, and have a food fight for 5 minutes about nothing. And it just goes on a loop over and over and over again. I know this because I used to book guests for those things back in the day. So that's infotainment. For example, when I left MSNBC, it was at the time, if you remember, Rush Limbaugh called Sandra Fluke a slut. And they talked about this for 2 weeks. Do I think it's unfortunate? Sure, I do. But do you need 2 weeks of coverage? But again, the media really nowadays is about, it's almost like a movie. You know, you have your protagonist, your antagonist, and kind of a script. And that's what I mean by infotainment. They're not covering, you know, they're not going to sit down with a single mother in Elkhart, Indiana, who's telling me she has to choose this week between paying for her own medicine that she needs or paying for the groceries, because they don't think people want to watch that. And frankly, your editor, executives making hundreds of thousands, if not billions of dollars a year, anchors making millions of dollars a year, they're detached from those people. It's like what I say about politicians. I don't think we should have politicians in Washington, D.C. Maybe they should go once a month to vote or vote, but they should be in their district. How are you supposed to know what's going on with people if you're not with your people? It's the same thing for the media. When you have people living in these coastal bubbles in New York and D.C. and L.A., how are they supposed to be attached or connected to real people's struggles? That's why on the campaign trail, and I write about it in the book, I met, I would talk to these corporate reporters at rallies, at this and that, in the press section, and they'd be talking about whatever story they're working on, Trump-related, and I'd say, you know, you guys should really cover Flint. I've been there a few times lately, and it's not improving like your headlines say. And they'd have this deer in the headlight looks. I don't know if it's because they don't care or they just don't know. I think it's a mix of both. But they're not connected. They honestly, if you're a human being, if you go down to Flint or you go to Standing Rock, it would take you probably 15, 20 minutes to be connected because it doesn't take much time to see the dire circumstances in both. But because if you're not there, how are you going to be connected enough to make your audience informed or interested in the topic? And it's unfortunate. And what's really, to me, amazing about the Young Turks, I know the Young Turks gets a lot of grief. Some people don't like some of the coverage with Trump and this and that, but we have a lot less resources than CNN does. I'm not staying at the plaza on the road. It's a real shoestring budget, yet we're doing more reporting than any of these multi-billion dollar conglomerates. And that's why I tell other people who ask me, like, how do I get into it? You don't even need to work for a Young Turks. I mean, it would be ideal. All you need nowadays is your phone, your feet, and some determination, and you could break a story. You really can. So it's really unsettling because most of these areas I go into, whether it's Flint, Standing Rock, I'm the only national reporter there. I was just in North Carolina last week for another water contamination story. I was the only national reporter. So it's a big opportunity, but it's a lot of responsibility since the media has really abdicated covering this stuff.
That's really powerful, and it's also, I think, a powerful invitation. You know, one of the things that really struck me when you were describing this was that, you know, our situation with the tremendous risks to climate, the, you know, decline of democracy and the takeover of these corporatist forces and all, you know, it's really, you know, a bad time. And the decline of the Roman Empire is something that, you know, one thinks about, you know, as being a kind of past historical epoch where the culture degenerated and it just, you know, went downhill. Of course, declining Roman Empire didn't take the whole planet along with them, but nevertheless. And, you know, toward the end, it was, as everyone knows, bread and circuses, you know, the most minimal kind of subsistence food, and then this gladiator conflictual entertainment in which someone got sacrificed. And, you know, in fact, what you're describing, and it's 100% the case, if you wake up to that reality and really take a hard look at it, or if you have a background in real journalism and see how far this has deviated, which is also what your book captures so well, this is really like, you know, the entertainment. You called it info entertainment. I mean, this is like what people are watching. They're watching a conflictual spectacle between two parties, you know, just as the Super Bowl, where people are dressed in blue and red and whatever, and then they align with one or the other, and they think that actually this process will result in, you know, social changes that will be life-sustaining and democracy-sustaining for all, and it simply isn't the case. You know, I just want, again, to give a shout-out to your book, Corporate Con Job, and, you know, listeners, you can go to corporateconjob.com and actually sign up. You can read the book chapter by chapter. As Jordan Chariton has described, chapter one is up, chapter two will soon be on its way. You can make a PayPal contribution of any amount you wish and read the book as it's written and as it develops and be part of, you know, an ongoing conversation, because I think this really captures what many people who watch independent media and who attended rallies and who are active and who care about this range of social issues experience and believe. But for people who – and so I think for people who are in that fairly substantial choir, if we really look at it and don't allow Bernie Sanders to be, you know, or Lee Camp or anyone who's telling the truth about this to be the targeted victim in this, you know, gladiator-like faux campaign of distraction that has become the mainstream news media, you know, if we can be validated in our understanding that's happening. But I also think that your direct experience within the campaign also makes this a good translator book for people to give to the people in their lives who kind of have not really wanted to face up to our current situation and the nature of the media that is shaping our understanding of what's going on in our country right now. So, you know, go there and participate, everyone. It's great. It's a great read. I mean, it's completely enthralling and fascinating.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm really grateful you're doing it. And let's just talk a couple of minutes about the novel delivery of this book. I mean, A, you came up with it because it suited, you know, your very demanding work schedule, and you very much have a story to tell and one that's really central to our problems and worth reading by everybody. So why did you decide not to, for example, just put the chapters together, you know, as they came along and go with a conventional publisher?
Well, if people know me, they know I'm not too conventional. So that was one of them. I kind of feel, from what I know about publishing and publishers, obviously there's exceptions to every rule, but I didn't want to be constrained. You know, I wasn't interested in like writing a book proposal and having it meet the standards of some publisher, you know, in their ivory tower, who would tell me most likely, you have to make it more like this and, you know, kind of less of this and more of that. Why I think I've had success is because I don't tweak my natural delivery or tone to meet, you know, somebody else's philosophy on what would make a good political channel, or in this case, a book. So that was one of the big things. I wanted to self-publish it. And hopefully, you know, as I released in chapter by chapter, you know, the buzz around it and the donations that hopefully come in will attract publishers. And the other reason was, you know, I think a lot of times when you wait to write a book and finish it, the things you're writing about, there's so much distance in time that has passed that it might seem a little less relevant, you know. So if I was actually going to wait and write a full book and wait for it to be finished, I mean, we could be talking into 2018 by then. Who knows
right. If
there's going to be another Standing Rock before then. Who knows what else is going to happen. And I just don't have the time because with TYT and other things I'm doing, it takes up the full day. I wanted to get this out while what happens to Bernie is fresh in people's mind, or what happened with the media and what they did to elevate Trump maybe isn't as fresh in people's minds and they aren't aware of what happened. Because, for example, I could tweet calling out CNN and these places about being hypocritical. Oh, suddenly, like, we have to take down Trump and be powerful in challenging media when we just helped elect him. But I could tweet it, or I could write a whole chapter on it and get it out. And I also think in this digital world we live in, it's not like the internet is the future. It's now. Now is the time to try different methods and to see what works. I mean, if this model works, it might be the type of thing that I want when I'm on the road in Flint or in wherever I am, writing in real time there and releasing little mini books while I'm in the moment, covering a Flint or covering a Standing Rock. It was a mix of not wanting to conform to the corporate publishing philosophy on what a book should be, but let's be real, if I went to a corporate publisher saying, hey, I'm writing a book that craps on corporate media and corporations and this and that, might not love it.
That certainly covers it. Let me ask you another question, since we haven't talked much about Bernie. What happened with Bernie in this last year? What's happening with Bernie and with the resistance and government now, from your perspective? I mean, you know, why do they hate Bernie so much? Even now, the New York Times went out of its way, weeks after firing their public editor, to try to lay the blame for, you know, one individual's kind of, shooting people at this event in Virginia. They tried to lay that at Bernie's doorstep because, you know, the guy was ostensibly a Bernie supporter. They just did a hit piece on Lee Camp, another highly popular, brilliant reporter and comedian, you know, who kind of tells the story in comedic terms, you know, with great creativity and flair. You know, why if Bernie is so inconsequential, if he's the person who couldn't win, if he's like a bumbling grandfather who isn't even photogenic, why do they even trouble themselves to go after Bernie and the progressives?
Right. Well, I think look at the difference between how they covered Bernie before the election and after. Before the election, you know, he wasn't getting really any coverage. Maybe he was on the Sunday shows from time to time. They didn't show his rallies. They didn't go into his policies, none of that. They certainly didn't go out talking to his supporters. But then suddenly after, when he didn't have any, there was no electoral chance, all of a sudden MSNBC and CNN, they want to do town halls with Bernie Sanders. They want to, you know, they can't get enough of Bernie Sanders. Does it have something to do with younger people are fleeing cable news for years? And they knew if they would attach themselves to Bernie Sanders, they're going to bring in younger viewers, which advertisers desperately want. So that is kind of the beyond hypocrisy, the cold hard truth. It's all about money for them. I think what's going on with Bernie now, you know, I'm not on like a speed dial relationship with Bernie Sanders. I know some people who worked for him and all that. You know, I think Bernie Sanders, it's a double-edged sword. He has the right message, but at the same time, he is a creature of Washington. So he does believe, and he wants to believe, that he can bring the Democratic Party over to his side. I don't agree with that. I think it's going to have to be more of a hostile takeover of the Democratic Party. But I think he has these relationships for 20, 30 years with Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Dick Durbin, these establishment people, that he thinks, you know, I got to just, it's repetition. Eventually they'll come over to our side. And I think that's what he's trying to do. I think eventually when he sees there's no chance of that happening, that's when these whispers and this silent, not so silent, but this under the belly call for like a draft for Bernie movement, or Bernie running as an independent, or Bernie, well, whatever it is, might get a little louder, because Bernie Sanders, you know, he's not young anymore, and I think he, in the years now that he has this mega microphone, wants to get some wins on the board. So if he doesn't see the Democratic Party moving over to him enough, which clearly they are not, I think you might have him, if not running, really coming out a lot more outspokenly against the establishment. Because make no mistake, I talk about it all the time, it's not enough just to get rid of Trump. If we're going to replace Trump with like Cory Booker or Kirsten Gillibrand, yeah, the language is less vile, but the policies are just are damaging. Neoliberalism in alignment with extreme conservatism is why you have that mother in Elkhart struggling, or that Portland homeless village, or all these stories I cover. So I think Bernie is trying to work within the system now. We'll see if that continues. But also, I'll say it out loud. I don't think his strategy in terms of media is always so wise. I mean, I think that he, you know, why are you doing town halls with MSNBC knowing that they're going to cover it when you're on and then go back to Russia for the rest of existence? So I would hope that he does more with independent media, with social media, and with the people who are championing the policies that he champions. It doesn't mean you can't go outside your zone and go on corporate media from time to time, but the people who watch CNN, they're not going to change their mind overnight about, you know, Medicare for all or taxing the wealthy. Really, I think what Bernie needs to do and what the progressive media needs to do is activate the base, because when you have an activated base, that's when you're able to maybe bring over some people from the other side through education and showing examples. I mean, my parents are a perfect example. They're both Fox News watching Kool-Aid drinkers. They're both good
people. Oh, my
God.
Well, I withdraw what I said about your mother then.
Yeah. I mean, they voted for Bill Clinton, you know, but they watch Fox News. But when I show them videos of, you know, water protectors in Standing Rock getting brutalized, they're like, why isn't this on TV? Why isn't this out there? So I always say most people aren't like lacking compassion. Most people don't know what's going on. That's the truth. So that's what I think in terms of Bernie. My hope I've never seen a healthier 75-year-old, so I hope he's seriously considering it. I would love to cover that, and I think that he is probably the best chance we have at this point of taking real power in the progressive movement.
Thank you. You know, let's just talk for, you know, the 7 or 8 minutes we have left here about Standing Rock, because that's another notable area of mainstream media blackout. You were there. You covered it. You know, what's your perspective on what went down there? And is it just an isolated thing affecting, you know, a Native community in this distant location? Or is it really a message for us all and have, you know, much, much wider, more global implications?
I mean, that's why I think it's beyond ridiculous, all these people ranting and huffing and puffing. Our democracy is under attack under Trump. I mean, what did you call Standing Rock before Trump? I mean, when people are being shot at point blank with rubber bullets and tear gas and grenades for exercising their First Amendment, that's not democracy. That's frankly, what happened in Standing Rock, I'm not going to equivocate, was fascism. I mean, it's literally the U.S. federal government. The reporting from The Intercept came out. You had the FBI, the Homeland Security, U.S. Marshals working with this Blackwater-type private contractor to protect an oil company. I mean, that's fascism. So what happened in Standing Rock, that these outlets want to talk about, we can't normalize Trump. Well, you can't normalize fascism, and you can't normalize, I don't care if it's indigenous people under attack, environmental people under attack, any person in America. I would say the same thing if it was redneck hillbillies protesting, you know, for the NRA. They should not be brutalized and shot at. And that's what happened. I mean, I was there 7 different times in the span of 5 months. From like very rare instances, there might have been like, you know, water protectors tossing a water bottle at a police officer or setting fire to a car, in some cases, to protect themselves so the police wouldn't come. But that was, you know, very, very rare, and I reported that. The overwhelming majority of time, you literally, it was like Afghanistan or Iraq, and it was an insurgency against American citizens. I think Sam Ronan said it's the first war America's fought domestically against its own people for oil. So it's very troubling what happened there. It's a lot bigger than just the pipeline. What happened there? It shows the length that this unholy cabal that I've talked about in the book a lot, the banks, the lobbyists, the corporations, the media, and the politicians will go. I mean, the few times you saw CNN there, it was not like to report on the movement or anything like that. It was because they thought that, oh, there might be a huge shootout between veterans that were coming in and police. They weren't there from the beginning. They weren't there like Amy Goodman or I or documentary filmmakers or Al Jazeera. So what happened there is a very important thing for people to understand, a very important thing for people to know going forward, because they're not stopping these pipelines. And if they do it, if they will do this to people to get a pipeline through in service to an oil company, well, they're going to start putting pipelines through daycare centers. They're going to start putting it through senior citizen homes. And you already see in Nebraska, it hasn't been reported, but the police, in expectation of protests for Keystone 2.0, have already stacked up with these non-lethal, quote, non-lethal weaponry in expectation of protests there. So I did my best. I still report on Standing Rock when there's news. Obviously, the judge recently ruled that DAPL broke the law and now is weighing certain actions. I don't know if they'll shut it down. That's a stretch. But Standing Rock to me is about, Standing Rock was ground zero for everything that's wrong in this country. It was not reported on at all, really, in the corporate media. And really, it changed me not only as a journalist, but as a person. You know, you got to check whatever white privilege you have was definitely checked a lot. Because speaking with indigenous people really changed my perspective. It made me a better person, journalist. And I will continue to cover these stories, because not just going to affect indigenous people, it affects all of us. It affects all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, I've covered Standing Rock on this program, and the week prior show was all with the people who have mounted that lawsuit and the plaintiff, Sarah Jumping Eagle, and you know, it is. It's a whole new, you know, the whole conversation and the racism that exists toward people of color or immigrants, or, you know, when the fact is that all of us, unless we are Native American, are the descendants of immigrants. So, you know, this tremendous confusion over what one's rightful place of belonging is in the world, this distortion of it is also exemplified by Standing Rock, because, you know, if you don't know who you are, where you came from, and who was there before you, you know, then you're stuck with these authoritarian narratives about who has rights and who doesn't. And the fact is, we're nowhere near understanding that we all do have rights, even as, you know, descendants of immigrants. But, you know, the First Peoples should have extra special rights. And in fact, you know, this is like almost like they're willing to poison and eradicate them, you know, or our government is, you know, for what? Do you think the corporate media is has direct ties to the fossil fuel industry? I mean, apart from, you know, ratings and eyeballs and, you know, having that business model, like, what's in it for them to, you know, allow the fossil fuel industry, which is destroying our climate and, you know, and here hurting people and poisoning water supplies, you know, of 20 million people, it's been estimated. What's in it for them to support that and not to report it and to kind of let it pass unnoticed like it should happen?
If you're watching MSNBC this morning, Koch brothers have commercials running. If you watch, you know, Politico has Bank of America sponsoring this morning breakfast series they do. Vox.com, I listen to their podcast sponsored by Goldman Sachs. You've seen energy companies advertising on CNN, and it's not just directly the fossil fuel industry. These banks that were heavily invested in Dakota Access Pipeline and other pipelines, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citi, Bank of America, they all do business with corporate media. I just told you, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs advertising. I've seen Politico Playbook, the big email list they send out, sponsored by Morgan Stanley. MSNBC segment sponsored by Bank of America. The list goes on and on. So it's not just directly to the fossil fuel industry, but the bottom line is, again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, when you have corporate conglomerates who directly lobby the government, who directly do business through investments and other things with banks or oil companies, they're not so interested in covering things that would be detrimental to those banks or oil companies. And it's a shame. At a certain point, you have to wonder, when does, you know, just basic humanity and morality step into the equation? You know, when Les Moonves says, Donald Trump's terrible for America, but great for CBS, well, when do you start caring about America more? You know, so that's a widespread problem. You know, I'm not condemning all executives or journalists at these outlets. There are some good journalists at these outlets. I know some of them. But at the end of the day, the facts are the facts. You know, by them pushing or not even covering things like Dakota Access Pipeline, you are complicit if there are spills. You are complicit when climate change when the chickens come home to roost, which is already beginning to happen around the world. You're complicit in that. And at a certain point, it doesn't matter how many yachts you have or Porsches you have, if we're all dead. It doesn't matter. I hate to be doom and gloom, but that's the facts. So that's why they are directly tied to the fossil fuel industry. And by the way, I didn't take many journalism classes. I think that's a good thing. But there are not two sides to every story. And that is the false notion that these Journalism 101 professors teach. They teach you to stand like a robot and be neutral, which is wrong, and they teach you got to show both sides. Well, there are not two sides to climate change. There's just overwhelming data. There's not two sides to the gun debate. There just isn't. We just have data. We have what happened in Australia. They got rid of guns, and they haven't had a mass shooting since. So I think that's part of the problem. It's this profit motive, and it's also this false neutrality / two sides to every story notion. And when you do that, you have uninformed, misinformed, or worse, people running around, and it's hard to really create the change we want to create if you are also combating just you want to talk about fake news? It's not only fake news stories. We're seeing fake news every day on CNN, in the New York Times. Of course, New York Times, there are some great reporters that do foreign work or put their lives on the line. Can't blanket everybody at all these outlets. But overwhelmingly, fake news epidemic is not new. And the problem is it's not just fake news. It's the stories they select, it's the lack of context, and it's the bias that they don't disclose. And that is causing not just fake news, but fake notions around the country. And that's how you get. Thomas Frank wrote that great book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Why do you think majority of the country is voting against their own interests? They don't know their own interests. And that's something that I will continue to fight for until I no longer can fight for it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole fake news thing is to actually teach people to, kind of become the eyes and ears and extensions of this corporate media, and to actually question, distrust, and reject any information or perspective that comes in from outside of it. I mean, that is the net effect. I mean, it's not just about clickbait sites. It's actually recruiting people to be their little soldiers. And, that's a big problem. They want to quantify things. Very often people will come on. I report a lot about toxicity, the health and environmental intersect, and people will come on and say, well, prove it. Where's the studies? Like they're being a good soldier. They've been taught to ask for proof. And, the problem is that science research is also paid for by pharmaceutical companies and others. And so, that research doesn't exist. We're not looking we're not studying, we don't know, we don't have the data. We're deliberately not getting the data. Any tear down of regulations is assuring that there's never any compulsion to get the data. And then, we're training people to kind of be good soldiers and ask for proof of something that, there's been a decision to omit. And this can be through omitting to study it, to omitting to reporting on it. So it's not just what is said, it's also what is not said, what is omitted. It's been fantastic talking with you, Jordan. Thank you so much for being on the show. I want to again point you listeners to http://corporateconjob.com. As you can see, Jordan is brilliantly articulate. He's apparently well able to write a brilliant book and do incredible coverage at one and the same time. I think you want to both watch him on the Young Turks Network and follow his coverage. Follow him on Facebook and also, support this book. I think it's a great model, and I agree about the timeliness of it. And for anyone who wants to revisit what happened last year, where it led us, and the role that media played in that, this is like a perfect way to do that. It's a really easy and, terrific read where you're kind of gasping every few minutes because he has rooted incredible stories of real people and real things that happened, in his central role of being, the independent investigator and reporter on last year's campaign, which has led us to where we are now. So thank you so much again for being with us, and I'm going to keep reading the book for sure. I really love the first chapter and can't wait for the second.
Thanks. And if you don't mind, I just want to, if readers aren't aware, I also have launched recently a separate site that I'm running. It's called Truth Against the Machine. So it's like Rage Against the Machine, but Truth Against the Machine. And what I'm doing is really trying to bring together up-and-coming independent journalists from around the country to focus on state and local corruption and injustice rather than, whatever Trump is tweeting and the national horse race. So we've been up and running for a couple months, and we're doing really great stuff on local stories that you literally won't find anywhere else. So truthagainstthemachine.com. And, any donations for the book or Truth Against the Machine are well welcome. People don't know this, but I am not just reporting on the struggle. I got a little bit of student loan debt myself. So your contributions to the Jordan Chariot and Poverty Fund is appreciated.
That's amazing. You're through Truth Against the Machine, you're reconstituting the structure of journalism. Thank you. I think that's a really fantastic and important thing to do. And, you know, bravo. I, you know, came up as a local reporter reporting out of the New York Fractivist Movement. So, yeah, we need to do that for all of, because this, the kinds of things that we're talking about here affect all communities in every part of the country. And, you know, who's elected there, the initiatives that are allowed or decided upon, the things that are regulated or aren't, this all goes on the state and local level. That it couldn't be better to do what you're doing with that too, again. So thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots with Jordan Chariton. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Chin up, keep marching forward, and standing tall with all our relations. Well.